This is Aiden with oddballpilot.com, here to interview Brad Adams in Talkeetna, Alaska. Brad and I have been working together at Talkeetna Air Taxi this summer, and we were sort of talking on the ramp one day, and that's sort of our various backgrounds, and Brad started off doing Part 91 flying for lodges out in the Aleutians, flying hunters and fishermen in Alaska. And that's often the job that pilots think they're going to be doing when they come to Alaska, and then the reality is they end up doing air taxi flying to villages. So I thought I'd sit down with Brad and kind of ask him how he got into that kind of flying and what it's like and how you actually make a living doing a job that's seasonal. Works a couple months a year, most likely, or 4 to 5 months a year. So, Brad, let's start off with how you got into flying and why you got into flying.
Well, flying itself I got into just my own personal interest. As a kid growing up, I was always interested in aviation and flying, and I envy some of my friends who grew up in families that flew, and my family wasn't an aviation family, so I started a little later than probably most people, but, you know, a buddy of mine and I finally decided one day it was time for us to, you know, just make the decision and fly, and so we actually bought an airplane together and then started flying, and of course, originally, I had no intentions of ever flying for a living. It was just only for my own personal use, and the rest of it came by accident, basically.
Okay, what type of plane did you buy?
We actually bought a Piper Super Cub.
And what year?
Was the airplane, or what year did we buy
it? What year did you buy it?
We bought it in 1986.
Okay. And how much, this is just a curiosity thing, how much did you pay for that airplane?
We paid $11,000 for it.
And how much do they go for these days?
If you bought an airplane today that was at the same level that that plane was right now, probably $75,000.
Wow, so good choice. Good choice for a plane to buy. So you got into flying pretty much planning on flying for fun, personal flying. And you had a story about how you got your license. You had some pressure when you went to get your license. Isn't that correct?
Yep. I had already moved to Alaska, grew up in Oregon, and spent a couple years in Montana, and was living up here, but had purchased the airplane from a guy down in Montana, and was set up to take my flight training in Oregon. So a good friend of mine who was a pilot went out to Montana with me, helped me fly the airplane back to Oregon, and I basically had 6 weeks before I was leaving there to come back to Alaska to go to work, and so I had 6 weeks to get my private pilot's license, which I did in 6 weeks.
That's pretty good. That's a good. That was in what year?
1986. Spring of 86.
Okay, and then you flew the plane on up to Alaska.
Actually, I had to get back up here, so I was actually driving a vehicle up, and actually a real good friend of mine actually flew the airplane up for me about a month later.
Okay, so you had the plane up in Alaska, and
yep.
You were living in Soldotna then too.
Yep.
Okay. Did you know that you were going to be working at lodges then? Were you doing hunting or fishing guiding?
Nope, I basically got into flying so I could go hunting and fishing and hunting, camping, exploring just wherever, whenever I wanted to. And that was my total intention of getting into flying. I had no intention at that time of ever doing it professionally.
So it's just, as a classic Alaskan, just a way to get out to your playground.
Exactly.
Okay, how did that morph into a flying job where you're getting paid to fly?
I originally came to Alaska to work as a fishing guide, which I was doing when I first came up here. And once again, like I said, just got into flying so I could go enjoy fishing or hunting or whatever on my own. And then I got invited to work for a guy for one season, actually part of one season as a hunting guide. It was actually a friend of mine who was a hunting guide, assistant guide. And he was telling me about the place that he worked, and it was all very interesting to me as a hunter. And he said, hey, the guy that I'm working for needs another guide for like a month and a half next year. He's short one guide. And would you be interested in doing it? And even then, I had no intentions of becoming a hunting guide in Alaska. But I thought, well, wow, you know, I mean, I'd love to hunt.
Yeah.
And I could actually go do this for 6 weeks and get paid for it. And so I called the guy up, and one thing led to another. I wound up getting hired by him to work for him as a guide the next season.
And then he said that sort of morphed into once you were working as a guide, one day he found out you were a pilot. And said, hey, we need someone to go pick these guys up, go.
Right. And how that all happened was, like I said, I actually went up and interviewed with him for the job. And at that time, he didn't even know I was a pilot, let alone owned an airplane. And he found out later on just through our conversations. And he made the comment, he goes, well, shoot, he goes, bring your airplane up to the lodge, and, you know, maybe if I even have you do some flying, I'll pay you for it. And there again, as a young person, I thought, wow, that'd really be cool, actually, someone's going to pay me to fly my airplane. But like I said, I was hired as an assistant guide, and about halfway through the season, when I was working for him, the pilot who was flying for him, the guy that I was working for wasn't a pilot, had a pilot that did all of his flying for him, and had made a commitment to him to fly through the end of the season, and had another job lined up that he was supposed to work on after that season was over.
Right.
And that was a very permanent job that he was moving into, and it started earlier than he anticipated. And so the guy that I was working for halfway through the season came to me and said, hey, you know, would you be interested in doing some flying? And once again, I thought, heck yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah, and at this point you just have a private license.
Private license.
And that's, and you were an certified assistant hunting guide.
Assistant, licensed assistant guide and private pilot, and basically the requirements were you had to have either a commercial pilot's license, which I did not have, or 500 hours of Alaska time,
okay.
And I qualified for that, no problem.
Cool. So that worked out pretty well. So you almost got into the flying side of it by accident.
Exactly.
It was through your hunting job. Do they hire people who are just pilots? Or
they,
you pretty much have to be a guide and work into it from that angle?
They do. Some operations do, but most of them, it just fits a lot better. It's a lot better fit if they are a licensed guide.
Okay. Yeah, because you know where to take the people to drop them off.
Right. And if they're not a licensed guide, they either have to have a transport license or actually have a 135 certificate to do that work.
Okay. When you started flying, was it more flying or more guiding? Did it go immediately from where you're guiding primarily to where you're flying primarily, or is it a mix?
When I started, it was more guiding than flying, and then worked into more of the flying part of it.
Okay, these days you're doing more flying?
More flying now, yeah.
Okay. Like I think you were saying earlier today that you'll actually, if it's really busy, you'll fly a guide out, and you drop them off, they do their thing, and you go do your own thing.
Right.
And they've gone through a few changes, or they've attempted to make changes to the regulations. I remember when they did that, they tried to make all the 91 guiding operations Part 135.
Correct.
And then you would have had to get a commercial license.
And basically, they did. Technically, there was a short time period there when we were required to have that.
Right.
Because the FAA came out in the mid to late 90s and telling basically all the pilots that flew for hunting and fishing lodges that you are 135 operators, we've just never enforced it, and you guys are going to have to comply.
Right.
And so for a while, there was obviously just a big dispute. And so there wasn't a whole lot done, and then it became apparent that the FAA was going to really follow through with this. And so really what happened was a lot of us pilots that were doing that type of work were all scrambling at that time to get our commercial and instrument rating because we were going to be required to have that.
Right.
And the APHA, which is the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, filed a lawsuit against the FAA saying that, no, we're not a Part 135 operation. And they agreed that, yeah, maybe we should be more restricted than Part 91, but not as restricted as a 135 operation. Because if you look at the hunting and fishing lodges in Alaska, as remote as they are, if they were required to completely comply 100% of the 135 restrictions or regulations, it would be very, very tough to comply.
Right.
I mean, you obviously would have to have a AMP in your camp or your lodge, which a lot of them do.
Right, but it goes way beyond just the pilots at that point.
Exactly.
And they need a certificate. So yeah. They have to get a 130, they need all this paperwork, they need a chief pilot, a director of maintenance, director of operations.
Right.
You're right. I've never thought about that. So I remember when that was going through, and I'm like, well, what's the big deal? Everybody gets their commercial license. Of course, they're flying.
Right.
They're
but
flying
it's
passengers.
The whole operation.
But it's the whole operation, and the view that you guys take isn't that you're flying passengers, you're flying clients out hunting.
Right.
They're not your... And yet, the airplane's just transportation to the hunting area.
Right.
So like driving a van.
And we do fly passengers, and it is part of what they pay for, but it's incidental what they're doing. They aren't booking a flight with us. They're booking either a fishing trip or a hunting trip. And yes, we use that as transportation in between. But
right.
a 135 is an on-demand charter. We are not. They are not an on-demand charter.
And they're not paying for the flight.
Exactly.
And I suspect that's a big part of the legal argument right there is that they're paying for the whole service, and the flight's
exactly.
just part of this.
It's incidental to the service.
Right, yep, exactly. And you fly fishermen, too, not just hunters. And you're
exactly.
saying that you actually take, when you fly fishermen, you tend to go out with them for the day.
Yep, we fly out, land wherever we're going to fish with them, and then we spend the whole day with them. We are their guide.
So you get to go fishing all day?
No. I wished I did. I get to watch them fish.
Okay, well.
Retie their knots for them, retie their flies for them.
Right, put the bait on.
Land their fish for them, release their fish for them, cook lunch for them. And then we're all done, clean their fish for them, and then put them in the airplane and fly them back to the lodge.
Go, that sounds like being a climbing guide.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know all about it.
Yeah. Feed and water people. So when this talk about the change, you actually went down and got your commercial instrument rating.
Yep, during that time period when it was coming down to crunch time, I did. I went down to an accelerated flight school, and I got my commercial instrument rating. And it's good knowledge to have.
Right.
I mean, it's probably something I should have done before that, but I wasn't required to do it, so I never did it. But it's definitely good training, good knowledge to have those.
How important do you think the instrument rating was for that? Because you're flying a Super Cub with limited instruments. You're landing on ridgetops and gravel bars. It's pretty VFR. Do you think the instrument rating was extremely valuable, or just kind of, a commercial rating, I would understand, to get do some maneuvers, or is the instrument, did you find that actually be something that you could apply to your job pretty quickly, or is it?
I would say I don't apply it at all,
okay.
because like you said, everything we do is VFR.
Right, yeah.
But just flying in Alaska, and where the weather is very, very dramatic, changes very dramatically, very quickly. It's good knowledge to have. I never have been in that situation where I had to rely on it.
Right.
But it's good knowledge to have. But no, I mean, we don't use it, because like I said, we're totally VFR.
Okay.
There's no instrument approaches to anywhere we go. We basically leave the lodge, and then we go out and land on gravel bars, ridge tops, tundra patches, beaches, and obviously there's no approaches or any kind of instrumentation at all in that. But there again, like I said, it's good knowledge that any pilot flying Alaska, it's not going to hurt to have that knowledge.
Right, sort of just as your progression as a pilot, it doesn't hurt to get a little more training.
Further your education, exactly.
Yeah, so let's go into sort of what your daily life of the lodge, and you're out in the Aleutian chain, or not? You're not in the islands, you're on the Aleutian
chain. On the peninsula, the Alaska peninsula.
Yeah, where there is pretty horrendous weather.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these lodges that I've heard about are pretty nice. Do they have, employee housing that you're living in, or are you living in the lodge?
No, we have employee housing.
Okay.
So we have a main lodge that consists of a very large kitchen, a very, very large and comfortable dining room, and then a nice living room area with some couches that overlooks the river, and we have an incredible view of the volcano out the back of our lodge.
Which one?
Mount Biniaminoff.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah, it's an incredible volcano.
Yeah, I mean, I bet I've flown by it.
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have.
I just don't know the name. Huh.
8 days out of 10, you can't see it because of the weather, but it is an incredible view when you can see it.
Right.
But anyways, the lodge consists of that, nice, comfortable living room. So the guests, in the morning, come into the lodge, mill around, visit in the living room area, and then have breakfast. And then we fly them out, or they depart by boats with the other guides and fish the local river, so we depart during the day.
And do you have breakfast with them, or is there a separate breakfast, or do you kind of mingle the guests and the guides all, and the pilots all kind of mingle together, or
Every lodge has their different protocol.
Okay.
It's interesting how some lodge owners want their employees completely segregated from the guests, and other lodge owners want them involved. And the lodge I'm working at, they want them involved. So we actually have a separate table, but it's in the same dining room, so we eat. Basically all of our meals with the guests.
Okay. Yes. That seems like that would work pretty well. But, I mean, a lot of the guests would, I mean, part of, if they're getting the whole Alaskan experience. It's not just that they're out hunting or fishing, but they get to hang out with their hunting guide / bush pilot.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, they want to, visit with their guides and stuff
right.
like that. So
right.
I think that, like I said, every owner or operator has his own way of doing it. But I like the way that we do it, and I think it is a good way, because I do think the guests, they do want to visit with you,
yeah.
Other than just when you're out on the river during the day fishing or whatever.
And so you get, after that sort of the breakfast, then you go, it's about 8 o'clock when you get moving, or do you have a sort of set time when you're trying to roll in the morning?
One nice thing about the lodge where I'm working right now is we are quite a ways down on the Alaska Peninsula, So we're quite a ways away from the majority of the other fishing lodges in Alaska.
Okay.
Which are fairly competitive, or a lot of them are, where we're not. So our schedule is a very relaxed schedule.
You don't have pressure to get to that good spot before the other group gets out there.
Most of the rivers that we fish, we're the only people fishing there. So our schedule is clients get a wake-up call at 7 o'clock in the morning. Anytime after that, they start filtering into the lodge. And breakfast is served at 8, and then at 9 o'clock, we have boats that leave the lodge to fish the local river, and then we have airplanes that leave to fish neighboring rivers, and they all leave at 9 o'clock in the morning. And then everybody's usually back at the lodge by 5:30 or quarter to 6 that evening.
Okay. And your flights, when you're flying out, and we're talking about fishermen now, I think you mentioned the fishing season and the hunting season are quite different. So if you're flying out to a river for the fishing season, how long is a typical flight?
We're pretty fortunate in the rivers that we fish. The farthest river that we will fly to fish, and of course, depending on what season it is, what salmon, species of salmon are running, that's going to determine where we're going to go fish, and then, of course, weather, too. But the farthest river that we go fish is just a little over 50 miles away. So in the 185, it's a 20, 25-minute flight, and the Beaver a few minutes more than that. But so we're pretty fortunate we don't have real long flights to get to where we're going.
Okay, and then you fish all day and fly back.
Yep, we stay there with the clients, fish all day with them, and do our lunches on the river, and then fly back in the afternoons.
And you've mentioned that you don't, the lodges aren't in favor, really, of the pilot. Like, if you have other work to do, you don't leave clients out there because the weather changes quickly, and it's unlike the guiding that I do where people get stuck out there frequently. You don't want to leave clients out there overnight.
No.
So if the weather changes, you're packing in the plane and flying home early.
And the part of Alaska we are working in, it is very adverse weather that changes rapidly. So 90% of the time or more we do, we land the airplanes, the pilots are the guides, and we bring other guides with us.
Right.
We usually have one guide for every two or three anglers. We keep the airplanes with the clients. And that way, if the weather does change during the day and we feel like it's necessary to get out of there for safety reasons, then we can leave early. There are occasions where we need to use the airplanes during the day to haul fuel for the lodge or whatever.
Right.
And so we just, we wait till we know we have a really good weather day, and then we'll take extra guides with us, drop them off so that they can stay with the fishing all day. Then we may go move fuel that day and then come back and pick them up. But we really just pick our weather days for that.
When you're moving fuel, where are you moving it to? Like stashing at a spot so you can fly out lighter, fuel up?
No, just for the lodge.
Okay.
We have fuel tanks at the lodge. We've got a 1,000-gallon diesel tank to run the boilers and the generator that produces the electricity for the lodge. And then we have a av gas tank, obviously, for the airplanes.
Yep.
And then we have an unleaded tank that we use for the boats that we use a lot.
So you're picking up fuel from a hub. Where you can get fuel, then basically ferrying fuel.
Right.
Basically hauling fuel around. Okay. Do you have bladders you did, or 55-gallon drums?
A lot of guys use drums. We actually have a Beaver that has a 250-gallon belly tank on the belly. And then we have a 150-gallon belly tank under the 185. So those are two airplanes that we move all of our fuel with.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I was just thinking about when I was flying fuel, it was, one setup. That's all we did. So it was tanks of fuel inside the plane.
Right.
But I never thought about just doing it.
Because these are the airplanes that we fly our passengers into.
Yeah, they're multi-purpose.
Right.
And you just use that belly tank, use that for diesel,
right,
and flush it out afterwards.
Yep. They all have quick drains on the bottom. So if we are going from hauling diesel, if you're making multiple loads of diesel, you don't drain it each flight. But if you're going to go one load and get a load of diesel, and the next load's av gas or unleaded, then you just pull the quick drain and drain everything out of it.
Okay. And when you're doing the hunting season, that's more common. It's hunting, do you drop people off for multiple days? Okay, so they go out with set up a whole camp,
right. Yeah.
And then you turn into more of a pilot because you obviously can't do that.
Exactly, yeah. So during the hunting season, you are strictly a pilot or a guide.
Okay.
And so we're taking, we run multiple airplanes at the lodge, so usually we'll take a guide and a client out at the same time with their camp, drop them off, and then they'll stay there and hunt out of that camp for however long it takes to either get their animal, or sometimes we'll move them during the middle of the hunt. But so during the hunting season, you're not a guide and a pilot, you're just a pilot.
Because
there's flying that has to be done every day.
Right. Would you rather be a guide or a pilot?
I love aviation and I like flying, and that's why I am where I'm at now.
Right.
But I do miss being out in the field and hunting. right, as a, yeah. as a guide.
Yeah.
There's that's a lot of times that's a lot less stressful job.
Although you're with the clients 24 hours then.
That is true.
But then you
get so there's pros and cons to both sides of it.
And you're definitely, since you're here at TAT this summer, you're obviously moving into the more aviation-oriented
right.
side.
And this is the first time I've ever actually, in all the years I've been flying Alaska, I've actually worked for a 135 operation right. word. That is your, and that is one thing that's really been a big change for me is your sole job as a pilot.
Right.
If you can't fly, you know, and all the work I've done before, if you if day you can't fly or whatever, there's always work to be done at a lodge. I mean, there's a generator to work, there's a boat to fix, there's a, you know, sewer pipe that's got to be dug up. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And so this is a very new experience for me.
Are you liking it?
Yeah, very much. and not so much that not in the aspect that I, you know, all I do is fly now. I very much like working for Talbot right. Air Tax. It's a great place to work.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's fun.
Yeah,
it's good. And the loads mostly load themselves, which is great.
Yeah. All of our loads are basically passengers for the most part.
Yeah.
Which, excuse me, like you said, they load themselves and unload themselves.
And it's similar to guiding. We were talking about this today where it's kind of this it's like you have a 1 hour guiding experience.
Exactly.
You have interaction with people from different places.
Right.
And it's just a shorter period.
And you're in the entertainment business.
Right.
I mean, you're entertaining these people while they're up in the airplane, you know, talking to them, pointing out points of highlights.
Well, it's part of the service industry, just like the lodge jobs are part of the service industry.
Exactly, providing a service,
Yeah, and getting along with the clients is a key part of the job. Yeah. And do you notice that with the lodge work when you you do identify with the people that you're fishing with, and that's a major part of the job is kind of interacting with the passengers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. When does your the season start for the lodge work, the fishing and into the hunting?
Hunting starts usually in early May, and fishing starts usually around the middle part of June, and then the fishing goes usually through about the end of September.
And hunting and then starts hunting up goes, again.
And then, and then we hunt usually till the end of October, late October.
Yeah. So that's actually a pretty good season.
Yeah.
May, June, July, August, September, October, 6 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can people generally make enough, earn enough in a 6 month period to get through the rest of the year? Or do you usually have to find other work throughout the winter?
Most people that work in this industry do find other work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're working with your own airplane now, too.
Right.
So when you use your own airplane, there's probably extra, I mean, there's a charge for the plane.
Right.
Yeah, which is probably pretty nice.
It is, yeah. So I'm able to, and that's the other thing. It goes back to what we were talking about before, you know, the cost of airplanes. When you ask me, you know, what a Cub costs now, what a Cub costs before. And, you know, one thing I point out to people all the time is when I first started flying, like I said, I got in this totally by accident. And my intentions for being a pilot in Alaska was so I could do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it in my own airplane.
Right.
And at that time, I could afford to do that. I could afford to own, maintain, and operate a Super Cub with my income. And one unfortunate thing that I've seen in general aviation in the last 20 years, particularly with Super Cubs, but all small airplanes, but Cubs in particular, is the value has gone up so much that I feel fortunate now that I am able to actually make money with my airplane, because if I wasn't the airplane that I own right now, there's no way I could afford to have it.
Right. Do you think there are any, because we were talking about buying airplanes this year, and I've been poking around into a bit too. Super Cubs are way out of my price range, and it does seem like there's somewhat comparable replacements that are considerably cheaper. Do lodges consider if you got a Pacer, or a Pacer would probably be the only one I can think of, or a Mall, would those be planes they'd consider using as well?
For some situations, absolutely. Absolutely,
okay.
Yeah. And there's I think there's a fair amount of guides in Alaska that use Malls. And, of course, we use the bigger airplanes, too, the 185s and the Beavers. But one thing about a Super Cub in the guiding industry is there are certain parts of what we do that's going to be a Super Cub.
Yeah.
It's a really super short field, rough field work, which is a lot of the hunting, is a Super Cub.
Yeah. So sort of along those lines, when you're flying out, when you're doing the fishing, it sounds like you've kind of got set gravel bars you probably go to, and you know, okay, this is a gravel bar. I know I can land here. I've been here, you know, a bunch of times. The hunting sounds like it's a little more challenging because people will get their moose or get their bear wherever they get it, and they want to get, and you want to get as close to them as you can, so you don't want to pack that meat, you know, miles and miles to the airplane. So there's a lot of interest in finding a landing spot that's close to the kill. That leads to, I imagine, more interesting flying.
And that, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. That is where even our hunting camps pretty much are designated camps that we use year after year. Although some of those are on gravel bars and rivers that change every year. So every year you're always going out and saying, okay, well, I was able to land here last year, but I can't. I got to find a new place. But right. Those are pretty much set. But where the pioneering of new strips comes in is exactly like you said. Someone shoots a moose. It's a 1,600-pound animal. Our only mode of transportation of getting that moose out of the field and back to the lodge is on a guide's and a packer's back and an airplane. So you get very creative in finding a place to land when you're talking about moving, 800 to 1,000 pounds of meat and bone.
Yeah, and that's where the Super Cub really reigns.
And that is where the Super Cub is the sole craft that we're going
to
use.
What do you look for when you're trying to, and I know that this is a much larger topic than we get into here, but sort of in general, when you're looking for a spot to land at, what's your criteria?
Well, obviously the first thing is length.
Right.
You know, have you got enough room to actually get down, land, and get out of there? And then beyond that, it's just the approaches and then just the roughness.
Right.
If you're landing on a gravel bar, how big are the rocks? How big are the little washes that come through there? If it's a tundra patch, how big are the humps in the tundra, the tussocks? Can you land on it without flipping an airplane? And being able to pick those spots out from the air, and I can look back to when I first started doing this in total awe of pilots who could fly over something in the air and determine whether they could land there, and to where I'm at now and not where I'm at, where those guys were at, but I've learned a lot, and it's just experience.
Right.
It really is. I mean, it's really hard, especially in the beginning, to look at something from the air, because even a Super Cub, you're going over it at 60, 65 miles an hour, and to determine how smooth it is, how big those rocks are, how big is that little indentation that you see, and it just comes from experience.
And I imagine there are a few times when you're gaining that experience where you're like, huh, shouldn't have tried this one.
Knock on wood, I've dodged some bullets, particularly in my early career. I had a few very, very scary situations that I was fortunate that nothing right. happened, and I learned lessons from them. And a lot of other pilots have had more mishaps and unfortunate situations where their luck didn't run as good as mine. And yeah, there's a lot of bent airplanes because of it. But also, on the other hand, and along those lines, a lot of those incidences there are a lot of planes that get bent up or wrecked, we'll
right.
call them.
But usually people aren't hurt.
Exactly, yeah. People aren't hurt. It's a yeah. landing or taking off incident where a gear leg is broke, something like that. Yes, the airplane is damaged, but you're not going to get hurt.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's not like flying into the side of a mountain in a cloud.
Right, the Super Cubs are they land and take off so slow.
Right.
That's like a very low-speed car accident.
Exactly.
And like you said, it's usually you hit a hummock and it just rips the gear leg off and you just kind of slide to a stop. I mean, it's exactly what you mean yeah. by that. You just, it costs money.
Right.
Is what it comes down to. That'd be kind of fun to go out and figure that stuff out, though.
It's exciting flying, and that's one thing that I like about it.
Yeah.
It
changes.
It's challenging.
Right.
It's always changing, and it's always challenging.
Yep. How do you judge, I've always wondered this, and I've got a rough idea in my own head, but I haven't done a whole lot of serious off-airport work, how do you judge the distance of your landing strip? I've heard people use time, they fly by at X speed and count seconds off, or do you have any tricks, or you just kind of look at it and say, yeah, that looks like about 300 feet?
I do it, like I said, just by looking at it.
Okay.
And I feel comfortable flying on wheels that I've done long enough that I can look at something and know, and I don't have any kind of a system like that of counting, and I have heard of people doing that. It's just from experience, and I've talked to friends of mine that are float pilots, and I tell them the small, limited amount of float time I have, I wouldn't be able to tell on a lake, But
right.
But same thing, you take a very, very experienced float pilot, and they can fly over a pretty small lake, go, yeah, this will work, or no, it won't work.
Yeah.
But I just for me, it's just looking at it. It's experience and just looking at it, and I feel like, yes, I can do it, or no, that's just too short. And there again, where we fly, we have a lot of wind.
Right.
And that's a huge difference. I mean, if you've got a 10... 15, sometimes a 20 mile an hour wind, you can land an incredibly short distance with a Super Cub.
Your stall speed is what?
Book says 42.
Okay.
And it's right around there. You know, Gears guys say my airplane flies at 38 or whatever, but
right.
It's real close to 40 miles an hour.
Right. So you get a 20-knot wind, and suddenly you only need to be going 20 miles forward speed, which
right.
in a Super Cub you can do it probably a couple hundred feet.
Easily, very yeah. easily. In fact, I've used strips that were shorter than 200 feet with proper wind.
Right, yeah, that's, so the wind's the key. So you right. factor all that into kind of
exactly.
the equation.
Yeah.
And then I imagine sort of like looking back, yeah, you know, that it looks well, but it looks like a strip that I landed in over here, and it looks about the same distance, and so
yeah.
it should work. Tying back into something I've been thinking about more recently, to the float flying thing, it seems to me that even if you've been flying a long time, and you've been flying a long time now, you have a lot of experience in a certain area, and as soon as you venture beyond that area where you've been flying a lot, you're not back to the beginning, but you're definitely learning a new set of skills, even though it's still aviation, and it's kind of a new, like I've been just seeing with the skis, you know, taxiing
exactly.
on the skis is giving me fits, and I can fly the plane, but it's
right.
like a new thing. It's like, God, now how do I do? Like, I'll try this, I'll try that. So if you switch to floats, it's like, okay, back to
right.
ground
oh, yeah.
one. Let's start learning
yeah.
this again.
The mechanics of flying the airplane, you know, you're going to feel very comfortable. But yeah, now you're looking at different, you know, landing.
And,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I just found that's kind of interesting to try different things. And it takes a long time to get really good at it, though.
Exactly.
I mean, like yeah. you're saying, you probably feel pretty confident doing the off-airport stuff in the Super Cub. You've been doing it for a while. But even there, it always seems like there's a, yeah, but that old guy over there, he really knows how to do it.
yeah.
Although
yeah.
you're probably getting to be that old guy.
And that's one thing that impresses me about flying in Alaska is, and I know of some people up here that if you walked up to and asked them who's the best bush pilot in Alaska, they would tell you it's them.
Right.
And you know, it's so humbling flying up here because there are so many incredible pilots in Alaska.
Right.
Because aviation is such a huge thing in Alaska because it's so remote, such yep. a small road system. It's such a part of our lifestyle, and there's just a lot of people that have been doing it a long time that are really, really good at it.
Yeah, and some of them aren't commercial pilots at all.
No.
They just do it for they go fly and go hunting and fishing, and it's their off-road vehicle.
Exactly.
So sort of the last thing I'd like to get into is, if somebody was looking at getting into the type of flying you've been doing, flying for lodges, what would you recommend the path be for them? What would be the best way for them to get into flying hunters and fishermen for a lodge?
Well, first off, if they're gonna work for a hunting and fishing lodge, you know, they got to make the decision if that's what they really want to do,
right.
and they want to be a hunting and fishing guide. And like we talked earlier, if you're gonna do it in the hunting aspect of it, you know, you need to be a licensed guide. So start out working for a lodge, get your pilot's license, and a lot of some of the lodge owners out there are gonna help work you up in through the ranks, going to start you out flying their airplanes, you know, doing this and doing that. Obviously not moving clients, but going out, getting the license, making a decision that that's what you want to dedicate yourself to. And you know, as far as flying in Alaska, you know, pretty much nobody's going to hire up here without having Alaska time.
Right.
So if we're talking about someone from the lower 48 or something that wants to come up here to do this, you're going to have to come up here and build some hours because, number one, whoever you're working for, their insurance isn't going to insure you without a minimum
yep.
amount of Alaska time. So it's, you know, getting up here, building some Alaska time. And
maybe buying your own airplane.
Which is a good way to do it.
If you can afford it.
If you can afford it. And there's a lot of airplanes out there, like we were just talking earlier, that, you're not going to go out and buy a $80,000 or $100,000 Super Cub. There's a lot of airplanes, like you and I have talked about, Tater Crafts.
Rocket Champs.
Champs. Even the Pacers that are much more affordable, that are very good bush plane and a great tail dragger airplane to build time in.
Yeah, great to learn in them. What's the to get certified as a hunting guide? How long does that take, or to get enough so that you could be flying?
Right.
Doing some
well,
work?
To fly for a hunting operation, you have to either have a transporter certificate, like I said, or a 135 certificate, or you have to be. You have to hold an Alaskan assistant guide license, which isn't very difficult to get. You have to have held a hunting license in the state of Alaska for, I believe it's 3 of the last 5 years.
Okay.
And have to have killed at least one big game animal in Alaska. Those are the qualifications for timeline. And then there is a written test that you have to study and pass a written test, which
okay.
is not a difficult test. If that's you know, the type of lifestyle that you're going to dedicate yourself to. It's knowledge that you're going to have.
But it's still definitely, you don't just walk up and submit an application. You have to have at least 3 years.
Right.
You have to have been, had a license for the last 3 years.
Okay. In particular for someone from the lower 48, non-Alaskan, they're going to have to dedicate, they're going to have to come up here for 3 years in a row, buy a hunting license.
Yep.
And technically, they could just come buy a license and leave. They don't have to hunt.
Yeah.
But at least one of those years, they do have to go out and harvest a big game animal in Alaska.
Okay, cool. That sounds good. Well, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you.
And that's.
I hope this helps out in some small way.
I'm actually thinking, I've got a cousin who, he loves hunting and fishing, and he's just started coming to Alaska the last few years. And this would be something he'd be pretty psyched about.
Does he buy a hunting license up here?
I don't think he's worked at a lodge down in Icy Bay, but I don't think he's bought a license and hunted up here yet.
Well, if it's something he's thinking about, he should, like I said, just buy the license. You've had a held a hunting license 3 of the last 5 years, and harvest one big game animal means doesn't mean you have to hunt. But
it's
$85 for a non-resident license. Buy the license, then you've got you're covering part of the.
Well, I thought I'm going to direct him to this interview. That might actually he might. Find it interesting. This sounds like it's a job for not necessarily people who just like flying, but it's really an outdoorsman.
Exactly.
You need to be an outdoors person.
Right.
And that's almost as much about being outside as about the flying.
And if you want a job where that's all you do, you're just a pilot, you don't want to do anything else, then that really isn't the job you want. You want to go get a 135 fly for a 135.
Fly for an air taxi out in Western Alaska or something.
Exactly, where that is your job. Because if you're going to fly for a hunting or fishing lodge as a pilot, and there are some operations that's all the pilots do. I'm not saying that specifically.
Right.
But generally speaking, you better be interested in also the whole. And it's going to, it's going to make you more valuable as if you're looking for a job, you're willing and able to do more than just fly the airplane.
Right, yep. And if you can go be a hunting guide for a trip. A guide gets sick, but they've got enough pilots, and you say, I can go fill in.
Yeah, I can do it for 10 days. I can go do that, right?
Yeah, cool.
And same thing with the fishing, exactly.
Excellent. Well, let's wrap it up there, and we'll go socialize with the rest of Talkeetna.
Sounds good.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.